I got this.
You got it? Are you sure they're dead?
Oh my god, there's a giant bunny in the Grand Canyon!
And it's gone.
I'm assuming it's the batteries.
Oh,
oh god, it's four?
It's four.
Why do you have to go and ruin my fun? Fun killer? Fun jerk?
Partially eclipsed. Is this nice?
Hopi, Navajo, Lullapai, Paiute, Havasupai. These are words of the Western world. These are words of the world of the Grand Canyon. The world would be flooded and all creation would be destroyed, says an ancient Indian legend. The deluges came and all the earth was covered. When the flood ceased and all the waters rushed away to the sea, they cut through the rocky plateaus and made the deep canyons of the Colorado River. Many Indians of the Grand Canyon region still believe that the river is the runoff from a great flood that once covered the world. Chiseled into many angular and rounded shapes by the forces of erosion, this dry land bears witness to the power of water as a sculptor. 2,000 million years of earth building, piled layer upon layer, lie exposed in a setting that rivals the significance of man's works. At the edge of a caramel-colored river stand rocks that were formed 2 billion years ago, when the world was half as old as it is today. Halfway up the cliffs are the fossils of the first form of animal life, and at the edge of the rim, minuscule and representing milliseconds in the span of cosmic time revealed here, stands man. No matter how far you have wandered hitherto, or how many famous gorges and valleys you have seen, this one, the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, will seem as novel to you as unearthly in the color and grandeur and quality of its architecture as if you had found it after death or on some other star. John Muir, the famous naturalist, eloquently summarized the magnitude of this great rift. Ravens soar between its rims, their cries breaking against the silence of immeasurable time captured within its depths. Somewhere on a plateau, a coyote joins in song with the always rushing river below, while all life pauses, and as prehistoric man waiting out the long night in canyon wall caves must have done, listens and wonders. The year 1492 marked a turning point in man's history. Reverberations from that great year of discovery would roll over the next four centuries and across a new world, touching even this remote and isolated region. From the conquests of the Peruvian and the Aztec empires rode forth Spanish conquistadors. In search of gold, glory, and new territory to claim for Spain, the deserts thundered to the pounding hoofbeats of the stallions they rode. In 1540, Don Francisco de Coronado and a company of several hundred soldiers rode northward from Mexico, called New Spain, searching for the seven cities of Cibola, an Indian kingdom rumored to be rich in gold and jewels. In the province of Tusayan, the land of the Hopi Indians, they learned of a great river and chasm lying to the west. Captain Garcia Lopez de Cardenas and a small number of soldiers were dispatched to investigate. 20 days later, they arrived at the edge of the South Rim, the first white men to gaze upon the Grand Canyon. Several conquistadors made an unsuccessful attempt to reach the river below, but found that the buttes and towers that appeared from above to be the height of a man were higher than the tower of the Cathedral of Seville. The canyon was regarded as the final obstacle to a fruitless quest, and the entire company returned to Mexico. The walls of the canyon and the plateaus of its rims hold the story of the prehistoric people who lived here. The Navajo Indians named them Anasazi, Ancient Ones. Over 2,500 ruins and archaeological sites abandoned prior to 1500 AD have been located within the park. Sensing the power of nature captured in this jagged land, the Indians wove it into their myths and religions. Almost 4,000 years ago, ancient man sought out remote caves in the red wall limestone cliffs and placed his split twig animal figurines in the darkest recesses of the earth, practicing his sympathetic magic to ensure a successful hunt. Today, some Hopis believe the land of the dead lies beneath the Grand Canyon. Water, the core of existence in this moisture-starved land, had life, and springs had souls. They were placated with ceremonious offerings. Havasu Falls plummets 100 feet between Havasu's canyon's red walls to become still in pools of turquoise. Chemicals in the water create filmy travertine curtains wherever the spray touches, then evaporates, leaving a chemical residue that turns to stone. Cottonwood, willow, wild grape, and watercress flourish along its moist banks. Nearby is the home of the Havasupai, people of the blue-green water. Their 2.5-mile-long oasis is the only reservation found within the boundaries of a national park. They are a peaceful nation whose people say they have never killed a white man. Since they were never at war with the United States, the Havasupai Indian Reservation was established in 1882 by President Chester A. Arthur by executive order rather than by treaty. The Havasupai were driven from their home on the plateau by raiding Indians in the 12th century. The small population, never numbering more than 300, found refuge on the canyon floor 3,000 feet below the walls of red sandstone. The Navajo Reservation lies to the east of the Grand Canyon. It is the nation's largest, encompassing nearly 24,000 square miles, some of which reaches into Utah and New Mexico. Its population numbers nearly 100,000. The Navajos, who swept down from western Canada between 1000 AD and 1400 AD, raiding settlements along the way, settled down and copied the Hopi agricultural pursuits. In the 1600s, they acquired horses and sheep from the Spaniards, as well as the knowledge of working with metal and wool. They are semi-nomadic, moving with sheep and goats from winter to summer homes and doing some farming. Both Navajo and Hopi produce quantities of arts and crafts that rank with the most highly perfected and richest of the North American tribes. Colorful rugs and blankets are woven, the Navajo having learned the craft from the Pueblo people. Sterling silver jewelry is perhaps one of the most distinctive forms of craftwork. Jewelry crafted by the Navajos is usually massive, of simple design, and accented with turquoise. Hopi basket weaving is a technology that has remained virtually unchanged for the last 7,000 years. The three distinct methods of construction, wicker, coiling, and plaiting, that characterize the craft today, are shown in the oldest existing baskets found preserved in archaeological sites. The Hopi, whose small reservation lies within the Navajos, is perhaps the most representative pre-contact cultural entity surviving in the United States today. Contact with the Spanish, and later the reservation system, has had very little effect on the political and religious spheres of their life. the mother of the Hopi, say the Hopi Indians. In an arid climate that produces 12 inches of rainfall per year and a growing season of 133 days, there is felt an urgent need for supernatural assistance to assure the crops will grow. Religion to the Hopi is the core about which life revolves, and elaborate, complex ceremonials are performed throughout the year. The Kachinas are considered by the Hopi to be divine beings who act as intermediaries between man and God. In ceremonials, Hopi men who have been trained and initiated put on masks and dance with solemn ritual to personify the Kachinas. Through them, the people pray for rain, crops, and fertility. The snake in Hopi legend is a descendant from a tribal ancestor who journeyed by way of the river to the underworld home of the gods. There he met the snake people, one of whose maidens he married. Upon his return to the village, his snake wife and snake children were driven out by fellow villagers who feared their bite. This action offended the gods, and they sent a drought that the Hopi could lift only by welcoming snakes back into the village. The snake ceremony is a quiet, intense ritual in which live rattlesnakes, who represent lightning, are blessed and carried in the hands and mouths of the dancers. They are then released to carry the prayers of the priests to the rain gods to send rain upon the parched land. In the quiet mood of winter, the canyon is vast, stark, and raw. The cold wind coils and whispers around the stone formations as the canyon puts on its mask of white. At an elevation of about 7,000 feet, the south rim experiences an average snowfall of 5.5 feet per year. Snow rarely reaches the bottom of the canyon. It evaporates on the way down. Point Imperial, the elevated north rim, the highest point in the Grand Canyon at 8,801 feet, overlooks the beginning of the canyon where the Colorado River emerges from narrow Marble Gorge. In the foreground of every north rim view are striking architectural forms that are viewed only distantly from south rim overlooks. Narrow promontories intrude into the canyon, and freestanding spires, towers, and mesas thrust up from deep ravines. Nature's intricate engineering of this enormous channel is much more apparent here due to different erosion patterns than that of the south rim. Here, the sloping plateau causes surface water from melting snow and rain to eat away the canyon walls. The Colorado River, being high above sea level, could cause the canyon to grow 1/2 mile deeper. As erosion continues, the canyon will grow wider. The rock layers forming the canyon will erode, the cliffs will retreat, and after millions of years, the canyon will be no more. The Walhalla Plateau protrudes far into the canyon. The narrow spur connecting it to the north rim will eventually erode, leaving the plateau isolated. The limestone capping the plateau is 500 to 700 feet thick. It is hard and weathers into cliffs rather than breaking down into slopes. Cape Royal's prominent feature is Angel's Window. A massive arch has been eroded out of the Kaibab limestone. The canyon is a unique museum of living forms. The beauty and diversity of more than 1,500 species of plants and flowers, with their enormous interlinked complexity of life and climate, is almost equal to that of the natural range of the entire continent. The cliff rose, an attractive member of the woodland plant community, with its fragrant cream-colored flowers from April through June, is found on rocky slopes along the trail below the rim's de Tonto Plateau. From the forests of the North Rim to the river level where desert cacti flourish are four of the seven life zones into which all plant life is divided. These biotic zones are similar to those found from central Canada to central Mexico, The temperature on the north rim averages 35 degrees colder than that at the bottom of the canyon. Flowering in spring, and again after summer rains, the Colorado 4 o'clock is one of the canyon's most brilliant flowers. Found along the trails in the inner gorge and on the rims, its flowers open in late afternoon, remain open through the night, and wither shortly after daybreak. High summer temperatures of over 100 degrees are common on the desert floor, and annual precipitation averages less than 10 inches. Cacti are typical of the drought-resistant plants of the warm, dry Southwest. In the spring, delicate blossoms nestle amid protective needlepoint thorns. The grizzly bear cactus is found from the rims to the river and is most common on the Tonto Plateau. Its pink flowers appear in April and May in the Inner Canyon and in June on the rims. A wide variety of grasses and shrubs grow below the rim of the canyon. Sparse and brown in the heat of summer and fall, they will cover the slopes with a momentary mantle of greenery in the spring. Blooming once before it dies, the agave plant puts forth a mass of blossoms on its single thick stem. With stems up to 12 feet tall, its upper portion is completely covered with small, bell-shaped flowers. It has a wide, elevational range, growing not only on the rims, but also on the hot, dry schist of the inner gorge. In contrast to the Canadian-type forest of the north rim, the south rim perhaps resembles a rocky seacoast. The soil is thin, and the underlying limestone is frequently visible. The dominant vegetation is juniper and the small pinyon pine. Pine nuts are a food source for the Indians and for some forms of wildlife. A lone juniper maintains a precarious hold on the canyon rim. Growing out of rocky soil, exposed to cold, contorted by wind, it endures and remains a fitting companion to the canyon scene. Over 400 vertebrate species of animal life, birds, mammals, amphibians, and reptiles, are known to occupy the environs of the canyon. Mule deer are usually the largest animals seen in the park, browsing along the rims at dawn or early dusk. The diversification of wildlife in the park is due not only to the differences in elevation, but also the barrier created by the river and the canyon itself. The unique pink rattlesnake, varying in color from pale salmon to vermilion, is found only in the Grand Canyon. Its color may be an evolutionary change, an adaptation to the red rock among which it lives. This rare snake mainly inhabits the lower regions of the canyon, but is nowhere abundant within the park. Now we have canyon gorges and deep eroded valleys, and still the hills are disappearing. The geologist, in the light of the past history of the earth, makes prophecy of a time when this desolate land of titanic rocks shall become a valley of many valleys, wrote Major John Wesley Powell. The layers of shale, limestone, and sandstone that make up the strata of the canyon walls are called formations. Their story is a succession of submergences beneath the sea and emergences from the sea, the depositing of layer upon layer of sediments by water and wind, of mountain building and the tearing down of mountains, rocks ground to sand and carried away by river and sea. Descending into the canyon's depths, time falls away until, one vertical mile down on the dark, somber walls of the inner gorge, the earth reveals her geologic soul. Here is antiquity, 2 billion years back. The oldest rocks found in the V-shaped granite gorge were originally sediments deposited by a sea and then uplifted into mountains. The great forces of pressure and high temperatures changed the sedimentary rocks into metamorphic types called gneiss and schist. Molten material penetrated, creating seams of white and pink granite. Shallow seas covered the land during the Cambrian period of the 345 million year long Paleozoic era. This period saw a never to be repeated wealth of life forms in the world's oceans. Within these rock layers of limestone are traces of invertebrates, trilobites, crustaceans, and brachiopods, the record of the beginning of life on Earth. In the following millenniums, the environment gradually changed from marine to desert. Found within the rising formations are fossils from the age of fishes, the first creatures with backbones, ferns, and amphibian tracks, and finally, reptile tracks in sand deposited by desert winds. Seas twice again inundated the land. The limestone Kaibab formation, seen here at Mather Point, is the floor of human activities along the rims. It was deposited during the last period of the Paleozoic era. In the 160 million year long Mesozoic era, the Grand Canyon area experienced many environments, deserts, seas, and swamps. This was the age of dinosaurs, the era of flying reptiles. The present major division of geologic time, the Cenozoic era, began about 60 million years ago. A large section of the southwest was elevated high above sea level, and the Colorado River began carving the Grand Canyon. Forces of erosion have removed much of the red-brown rock of the previous era. Water is the greatest force in enlarging the canyon. Water seeps into the crevices of stone and ultimately freeze and thaw. Cracks appear, and eventually the rock splits. Alternate expansion in the sun's heat and contraction in the cool night air help crumble the stone. Gravitation continues to work on the walls incessantly. Weather erodes the softer rock, and water and rainstorms sweep tons of material toward the river and on to sea. It is by such ordinary processes of nature that the great size of the canyon is accounted for, 277 miles in length and 600 feet to 18 miles wide. The engineer of this colossal enterprise of nature is the turbid Colorado River, flowing its swift and tumultuous course between an avenue of vertical cliffs deep enough to conceal the Empire State Building. Until recently, it carried an average of 500,000 tons of sand and silt a day, as much as a 10-ton truck passing every second. These cutting tools deepen the gorge still further, cutting downward at the estimated rate of 1,000 feet every 2 million years. From its source in the Rocky Mountains to the Gulf of California, it travels 1,450 miles. The Grand Canyon is the longest and deepest of the many canyons carved by the river. In 1857, Lieutenant Joseph Christmas Ives led the first official survey partway up the river. Near present-day Hoover Dam, it became necessary to abandon the steamer by which they were traveling. Ives and his men explored on to the east and arrived at the canyon. The surface is furrowed by these abysses and bar all progress, he later wrote. Unable to continue on their course, he appraised the region as altogether valueless. It can only be approached from the south, and after entering it, there is nothing to do but leave. The Colorado River, along the greater portion of its lonely and majestic way, shall be forever unvisited and undisturbed. 12 years later, the river was not only visited, but was also navigated. Major John Wesley Powell, a small bearded man who had lost his right arm in the Battle of Shiloh in 1862, was the first to conquer the Colorado River, leading his expeditions through the canyons of the Green and Colorado Rivers in 1869 and 1871. After entering the formidable Grand Canyon on August 5th, Major Powell described the apprehension felt by the crew. We are now ready to start on our way down the great unknown. We are 3/4 of a mile in the depths of the earth, and the great river shrinks into insignificance as it dashes its angry waves against the walls and cliffs that rise to the world above. The waves are but puny ripples, and we are but pygmies, running up and down the sands or lost among the boulders. We have an unknown distance yet to run, an unknown river to explore. What falls there are, we know not. What rocks beset the channel, we know not. What walls rise over the river, we know not. With some eagerness and some anxiety and some misgiving, we are carried along by the swift water through walls which rise from its very edge. On August 29th, 13 weeks after beginning their trip down the great unknown, Powell and his men emerged from their granite prison. Powell returned to Washington a hero. The unknown had been penetrated and the canyon secrets revealed to the world. Proposals to protect the canyon as a national scenic heritage were advanced by Indiana's Senator Benjamin Harrison in 1882. However, his bill to make the canyon a national park was defeated by mining interests. But the canyon triumphed. On February 26, 1919, an act of Congress under President Wilson established the Grand Canyon a national park and placed it under the protection and administration of the National Park Service. At the top of Bright Angel Trail, the adventurer can ride down the steep zigzag path by mule. Not dangerous, but terrifying. There are often only inches between the rider and a sheer drop of hundreds of feet. But the sure-footed mule is very wise in all that is required to negotiate safely, and with a minimum of trouble to himself, the vertical descent. The trail follows the Bright Angel Geological Fault and is perhaps the oldest in the canyon. For centuries, bighorn sheep traveled it, the Havasupai Indians to reach their primitive farms before the coming of the white man, then trappers, explorers, and miners. The trail was improved by miners and was operated as a primitive route into the canyon. Every horse and mule rider was charged a toll of $1 until the trail was taken over by the federal government. Along the Kaibab Trail, colorful rock formations of awe-inspiring depth and size are open to hikers and backpackers on their journey to discovery. The spectacular trail starts at Yaqui Point and winds its way down the south wall of the canyon to Phantom Ranch. It was blasted out of solid rock and was engineered so that sunshine would keep it free from winter snows. It is, perhaps, the seasoned hiker, his home on his shoulders and experiencing absolute solitude, who best understands President Theodore Roosevelt's speech upon his visit in 1903. I want to ask you to keep this great wonder of nature as it is now. Do nothing to mar the wonderful grandeur, the sublimity, the great loveliness and beauty of the canyon. Leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. Keep it for your children, your children's children, and for all who come after you as the one great sight which every American should see. As smog and noise, steel and plastic push in on us, the need increases to save a place for our children's children to visit, to feel, to know the wonder and awe which all people feel when faced with the powers of nature. Once, man's place in nature was precarious. Now it is the wilderness whose survival seems uncertain. Western man, in headlong quest for progress, has long viewed the value placed on nature to be determined by its usefulness, an attitude justified as the mastery of nature for man's benefit. The legacy of the Indian culture is that man is a part of a delicately balanced universe, in which all life forms and natural elements interrelate and interact, that no one part is more important than another. Go and see it and understand, says an Indian legend. Grand Canyon, as do all our national parks, preserves not only the finest scenic and natural treasures of our country, but also the record of human discovery and occupancy. This constitutes our richest American heritage. Here is the opportunity to see, feel, touch, and understand. At worst, man is an interloper in this great wonder of nature. At best, its curator and preserver. Navajo, Lullaby, Paiute, Havasupai. These are words of the Western world. These are words of the world of the Grand Canyon. The world would be flooded and all creation would be destroyed, says an ancient Indian legend. The deluges came and all the earth was covered. When the flood ceased and all the waters rushed away to the sea, they cut through the rocky plateaus and made the deep canyons of the Colorado River. Many Indians of the Grand Canyon region still believe that the river is the runoff from a great flood that once covered the world. Chiseled into many angular and rounded shapes by the forces of erosion, this dry land bears witness to the power of water as a sculptor. 2,000 million years of earth building, piled layer upon layer, lie exposed in a setting that rivals the significance of man's works. At the edge of a caramel-colored river stand rocks that were formed 2 billion years ago, when the world was half of the, when the world caramel-colored was sculpted. 2,000 This by the forces of space. By the forces of erosion and rounded shape. By the forces of forces of erosion. Chiseled into many angular and rounded shapes by the forces of erosion this dry land bears witness to the power of water as a sculptor. 2,000 million years of earth building, piled layer upon layer, lie exposed.
Instead of setting the vitals that never reached the land where, at the edge of a caramel colored litter, stand rocks
that were formed 2 billion years ago.
When the world was half as old as it is today. Halfway up the plain.
Or the fossils of the first form of animal.
And of the earth to the rim, and a few representing milliseconds in the span of
cosmic time revealed here,
stands man. No matter how
or how many famous gorges
in
this one, the
grand
the theme is as unearthly in the color and grand color and grand color and grand in the color and grandeur and quality of its architecture as if you had found it after death.
What was it?
Or in some picture. Picture quality of its architecture as if you had found it after death. Or on some other star. You of this great rift. Joins in soul with the old historic man waiting up. Even this remote and isolated.
Oh.